Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Thank you for staying tuned. If you've just tuned in, my name is Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. To learn more about my organization, please visit our website at www.cfif.org. Well, it's my favorite time of the program. Once a month, we invite Quinn Hillier to the program. He's a senior editor of the American Spectator magazine and associate editor of the Washington Examiner. And he comes to talk inside politics. That's inside the Beltway politics, where he is located. Fill us in on everything that's going on from, the bailout, I guess we'll start with that one, to illegal immigrants, issues of judges, but I think everything, most of the things that's on everybody's mind these days, Quinn, and you can probably attest to this in Washington as well, is the bailout. What's going on there?
Oh boy, Renee. we're in a mess, is what we're in. Everybody in power, basically, said that if you pass this bailout, while it's not, the silver bullet that's going to solve all our problems, it will still stop the panic, that it will buy us some time, it will stop the economy from getting precipitously worse, and if you watch the markets since the bailout passed, those people were wrong.
The national and the international markets.
Exactly. Well, the fact of the matter is that on Friday, just as they were starting to vote on the bailout, the market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was up about 250 points for the day. When the bailout passed, not only did that very day did the market lose the 250 points that it was up, but it lost another 150. So it ended up down 150 for the day, which is a 400-point drop in about an hour and a half. And now today, it dropped as much as 800 points before finally closing down about 400. So since the bailout passed, the market has dropped a grand total of another 800 points. And this was supposed to be the thing that stopped the panic? I think not.
Well, as you point out in a column which you wrote before this thing, I mean, it was still table talk at that point, a column in the American Spectator, no thank you to Paulson and Bernanke. What happens when you commit so much government money to a bailout? And your answer is exactly right. It makes your government's own money less valuable. And isn't that certainly what's playing a part in, maybe not necessarily what's happening with the Dow Industrial, but what may be happening overseas?
Well, oddly enough, and while I still think I was right in what I wrote, I was saying that the bailout would weaken the dollar so much that that it would be sort of self-negating. That's what happened when Bernanke first announced his bailout plan. The dollar dropped. The price of oil had its biggest one-day spike in the history of mankind. But oddly enough, over the weekend, the dollar actually strengthened. Now, what's happening there, I think, is that the rest of the world markets dropped in comparison with the U.S. So even though what we did was we basically inflated the currency by doing the bailout, the rest of the world markets tanked so much that they started to see that they might be inflating their own currency even more. So, basically it's a downward spiral, and I don't know what's going to happen.
How does all of this, what are you hearing in Washington, the impact that it is having on the election, the upcoming election?
Well, so far, the clear effect of it all has been to boost Barack Obama and hurt John McCain, but I'm not sure that it's the economic crisis itself that automatically helped Obama. I think it is McCain's horrible, panicky, ham-handed response to it that has hurt McCain. I mean, this was a perfect opportunity for McCain to show what he meant when he said he's the guy to trust in a crisis. Well, Obama kept his cool, and while he he didn't do anything to help. He just sort of sat back and kept his cool. McCain ran around like a chicken with his head cut off. And that really, really hurt him and has put McCain in a deep hole that he now has to try to crawl out of.
Your solution, at least the one that you proposed in this column, is to eliminate the corporate income tax.
Well, that's one. That's part of the solution. Granted, that's and as I said in the column, that's not going to solve the immediate credit crunch, but it will help. It will help with everything across the board because it will make profitable companies immediately 35% more profitable, which means that all the lending institutions that are sort of afraid of lending to a company will now be 35% less afraid to lend because they'll see that the cash reserves, in effect, are a lot higher because 35% of their profits won't be going to the government. And so that could start freeing up capital to be lent, to be borrowed, to be invested, and that's just one of the many benefits of completely eliminating the corporate income tax.
All right, well, let me play devil's advocate then, Quinn, and help me understand what happens on the other side of that balance sheet when the government loses that 35% of the profits that would otherwise be coming in.
Well, actually, I got this idea 2 years ago about from a friend of mine who was a budget committee staffer on Capitol Hill for the Democrats back in the late 70s or early 80s. So he's not coming at it from some kind of supply side, conservative perspective. But even he said if you cut the corporate income tax completely, it would almost pay for itself. And he went down a whole list of reasons why it would almost pay for itself. Here are a few of them. Number one, if you eliminate the corporate income tax and the companies are making, therefore 35% greater profits, of course, those 35% greater profits are going to be reflected in the amount of dividends they pay and in the value of the stocks, which means that the capital gains tax and the dividend taxes that the government takes will immediately start jumping up. And so that'll take care of part of the loss. Another part of the loss will be taken care of by this. If you completely eliminate the corporate income tax, all of these companies that have been outsourcing jobs, that have been locating corporate headquarters overseas, or contracting out overseas in order to, have cheaper labor or whatever, all of a sudden they've got an incentive to come back to the United States. When they come back to the United States and bring all their business back, that brings jobs back, that means it brings taxpayers back, it does all kinds of things to boost the economy, and again, if you've got more taxpayers, again, the government is going to get some of those tax revenues, and that will pay for part of it. And there are a whole list of other reasons why this would, while it wouldn't completely pay for itself, it would come awfully close.
All right,
can you follow all that? Am I making sense?
No, you can. I can follow it. I mean, of course, it's and I think you've mentioned this, it's not a quick fix.
No.
I mean, that's obviously what you're talking about, bringing back, companies who've taken their business overseas, taken manufacturing overseas, or outsourcing it, bringing it back to the United States. That's a multi-year process.
Well, it is. But on the other hand, people in the market are bright enough to see what happens with how policy affects future actions. That's why, for instance, when George Bush got rid of the executive order that eliminated offshore drilling, immediately, I mean within 2 weeks, the price of oil per barrel dropped from about $150 to $120. Why? One, because all of a sudden there was more oil on the market, but the people that were speculating in the market all of a sudden knew that there would be more mm-hmm. oil on the market in the future, and they started acting accordingly.
Well,
this would have the same effect.
That's interesting. I know you've got an article, and I wasn't able to pull it up for some reason, dated October 5th about oil that I want to talk about if we have time at the end of the program. But I know one thing I've been watching is it seems that, as the price of oil has come down, maybe about 35% over the last couple of weeks and stuff, we certainly haven't seen a 35% decrease at the pump. But, that's off the subject. But let me go back to something you said, that the folks on Wall Street, the people who predict this stuff, the futures, the people who deal with that, they're bright enough to see, okay, we've got a horse race now. Who do the Americans have less confidence in, the politicians or the folks on Wall Street?
It's a race to the bottom. And for good reason, it's a race to the bottom because nobody is covering themselves in glory. But the fact is that there are two parts of Wall Street. They're the monetary debt traders, who are trading all these complicated derivatives and credit default swaps and all these things that nobody understands.
The amen.
They're basically casino players is what they are. But they're also the people that invest in ordinary securities, ordinary stocks. And those people are dealing in stocks that are, while they're paper, they are paper that actually reflect businesses that actually make real things. Those people, I dare say, are not at fault, or at least far less at fault, for the current problems than these high-flying bond and debt traders. Those are the people that actually look at real market forces on real things and will respond in the way that I've just described. In other words, they will respond rationally to current changes in policy. They'll respond rationally knowing what those policies mean for the future.
All right, I am a constitutionalist. I'm always eager to discuss, what our founding fathers would think. And you hit the nail on the head. Maddening for Madisonians. I mean, you think they're turning over in their grave right now?
Yes, they are. I think there's no doubt about it. I'm totally against this bailout. There are a whole lot of other things that can be done. In fact, Newt Gingrich said last week that there are literally thousands of ideas out there that could help without doing the bailout the way this was done. My problem constitutionally, problems are twofold. Number one, the aggregation of power, the consolidation of so much power into first the federal government and then within the federal government, within the Treasury, is so out of bounds. So completely against everything
limited government,
that the
sure.
founders that the founders meant to create with their brilliant creation of a limited government that I think it would make people like James Madison literally sick. And secondly, sort of procedurally, all revenue bills are supposed to start in the House, and the Senate instead jumped in and did a whole bunch of legislative tricks to attach this massive bailout onto other bills that had nothing to do with it and then send it back to the House and say, take it or leave it. And that, to me, even though, they can make a case that technically they didn't break the Constitution, it certainly violates the spirit of the Constitution. So on both fronts, I just think that this is horrible for those of us who actually believe in the founders' vision of limited government that operates according to rules we all understand.
What about Alexander Hamilton, our first Secretary of the Treasury? Would he be? I think even he wouldn't want all that power vested in that office.
Of all the founders, he would be the one most likely to want all that power in the office. But I think you're right. Even he might balk at it because. This is unprecedented. It is so beyond anything government has ever done before that I think it would give any rational person pause.
All right, we are talking with Quinn Hillier. He's a senior editor of the American Spectator magazine and an associate editor of the Washington Examiner. When we come back, we're going to focus on some other interesting issues, which Quinn has written about. These come from the DC Examiner. If you want to get a jump start, go to dcexaminer.com and just search his name, Quinn Hillier, Q-U-I-N-H-I-L-L-Y-E-R. We're going to come back and talk about illegal immigrants and Congress and judges, which are purportedly McCain's strong suit. If you want to read his work at the American Spectator magazine, you can find him at spectator.org. We'll be right back after this short break.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
All right, listening to that commercial for Lillo's has made me hungry because I know their food is fabulous. I have not yet been to the location out on Pensacola Beach, but I will be going there very soon. I remember when they were downtown and the food is absolutely wonderful. All right, we are going to get to some of the other issues that Quinn talks about in the Examiner, but before we do, I want to take a call from, well, he goes by Miami Ed, but now I'm going to call him Guacamole Ed. Hello there, Ed. How are you?
You're definitely 20 times prettier than the other guy that usually is there. And I'm glad you enjoyed the avocado.
I sure did.
The only place to get a key made, if you have a complex key, like for a vet or a five-tumbler lock, is Clark, because they get them right. Hasn't this, you know, I can't for the life of me comprehend John McCain. This was the perfect chance for him to make points with the majority of the people. The majority of the people were against this buyout. If he's so much against pork, why didn't he right this time go against it, and all of the Republicans should have voted against it? You know, it didn't have to be done last week on that Thursday, I believe it was. It could have waited a month or two, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be successful. And definitely, Speaker Nancy Pelosi didn't make things better by saying, well, we don't know if this is going to work. We think it's too little, too late. And just for just what you think about it, sir.
Well, I think you make some good points. As I said at the beginning of the show, John McCain missed a great opportunity. He had a chance to show that he could be the steady, level, far-sighted hand in... You can't have a far-sighted hand, I'm sorry. The far-sighted leader in a crisis. And he did not do that. And what he did was, in the end, not terribly helpful. And he came down on what clearly was the unpopular side of the issue, and I think substantively the wrong side of the issue as well. You know, I've never understood how John McCain thinks. He's right on some things, he's wrong on some things. Even when he's right, he can be annoying. I have no answer. The caller makes a very good
point. One more point that I would like to make. I sincerely believe that the talk from the Democrats for the next 3 weeks are going to be nothing but negative, and if the Democrats are able to keep the House and the Senate and they take over the presidency, all these government senators, congressmen, and so forth, and we know who they are, nothing is going to be done about them. You know, we had Barney Frank's boyfriend working for Fannie Mae. Now, what was his resume? I had a house of prostitution at a congressman's basement, and I ran it successfully and made a lot of money. Now, if I just totally cannot comprehend it. And all the Republicans could have had a big talk on the steps of the... They could have had speeches made on the steps of the White House saying, this is pork, this is rotten, this is going to cost our sons, our grandson, our great-grandson, a ton of money. And that's all I... And, Renee, you're the greatest.
Oh, thanks, Ed. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, it's interesting, Ed, because you bring up something that Quinn and I talked about during the break, because in the article that I referenced, the one which Quinn wrote called No Thank You to Paulson, and... No, it wasn't in that one, was it? No, where's the one that, which column was it where you list the name of the Republicans who stood by
Maddening for Madison.
Maddening for Madison, Madisonians.
Excuse me, for Madisonians.
And as you pointed out, and I'll let you finish this because we've only got about a minute left, but did they really have a choice?
I think they had a choice, although I can understand how by Friday some of them thought that maybe they didn't. But if they had stood firm and they had said, we're not against a solution, we will stay here and stay here and stay here till we get it right, but this isn't right yet. If they had done that, if enough of them had done that, I think they would have ended up getting something better than what they got. But, you know, a lot of them that did end up finally reluctantly voting for it thought that the solution would keep getting worse and worse and worse because the panic would grow. And so, you know, I don't hold it against them. I do credit them for standing against it in the first place.
All right, we've got about 35 seconds left and another caller. John, can you do it quick?
Yeah, hey, just which side of the coin? Inflation? I mean, hyperinflation or deflation?
Ooh,
that's
which
interesting.
Side of which coin?
Which way would you go? Hyperinflation or deflation?
Neither. I would go for steady money, a sound dollar that holds its value within a very narrow range and would not move too much in either direction.
Yeah, I think all of this was done in haste. And, you know, I'm afraid we're going to feel the repercussions for it for a very, very long time. And thankfully, we'll have Quinn Hillier back to talk with us about that next month. You can save your questions for him when he comes back. And Quinn, I'm sorry we didn't get to some of your other columns. You, of course, can read them at dcexaminer.com or spectator.org. Quinn, thanks so much for your time again.